or near enough. Sick and tired of that old man looking down on us. Come together as we think we got a plan. Save a teeny tiny traveling folk band.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Flat Nickel Podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Nawa, joined by my always producer and occasional co-host, Mr. Sam Fritz.
Hello.
We are recording these intros a little bit late at night. We had such a busy day yesterday. We had 3 back-to-back interviews. This episode is the second of those back-to-back interviews, and it was quite a hectic day. It's the most interviews we've ever conducted in a row in one day. And it was a lot of fun getting to see these people that I hadn't seen in quite a while, but it was definitely a very, very busy day yesterday.
Yeah, we took the hustle in stride, you know. We had a job to do and we got it done. I had a good time, I should say, getting to see all these different people. They were 3 of the 3 interviews that we've done. You know, our audience has already listened to 1, this again being our second, but of the 3 that we've done, they all had their own very unique vibe to them.
Yeah, each interview was very different, which was really nice because it kept it from feeling stagnant with us. Literally, Nick came into the studio as we finished recording with Shawan. It was back to back. And as soon as we finished recording with Nick, we were running across town to the studio. So it was a chaotic day, but all these interviews are pretty different from one another. So hopefully you guys will enjoy them and enjoy each artist's take on the topics that we discussed, which varied. I think Shawan's interview is very different from Nick's, and Nick's was very different from Sean's. And
Nick's, I think, was one of the stories that we've certainly touched on before, but again, it's unique with each person individually. But, you know, Nick was the person who was caught in a job that he just knew he wasn't going to feel content with, and he pulled the trigger on going into music, mostly full-time, correct?
He is full-time.
Full-time? Now. Yeah. So he pulled the trigger on going into music, and, you know, I think hearing about him recently becoming a father, you know, moving back closer to where he grew up, mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff to pursue a music career is a little bit of a unique twist on a story that we've covered a couple of times on the podcast.
And if you guys haven't listened to our Cody Wilt episode, definitely make sure you go and check that out, because we do actually talk about Nick in that episode, which is kind of where it reminded me that we need to reach out to Nick to talk about his life and his story, because his is very interesting as well. And I guess with that being said, should we go ahead and hop on into the episode?
I concur.
All right.
Hopping into the actual interview now that we've discussed coffee and coffee mugs. So this is my first time actually sitting down and having a conversation with you, I think. I have seen you around so many times. You've played
at Always on the go.
Always on the go. You've played at the Thought Lot a lot. You are a new dad.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Which I'm going to ask you some questions about that a little bit later on. But I want to start with, you've released 4 records, correct? According to your...
Yes.
Your website.
Yeah, we don't count the first one.
We don't count the first one? Why don't we count the first one?
My very first one was recorded on a little 8-track in my first apartment in Philadelphia about 6 years ago. And it did its job to get me to the next album. But it's one of those ones when you listen back, it's kind of cringeworthy. It's like the sonically, it's not very good. The performances are not actually exceptional. The songs were just very young, mm-hmm. and they grow after when you go out and you play 100-some-odd gigs a year, your songs tend to mature and they kind of worked out the kinks. Back then, I was only playing 25 gigs a year, if that. So it was, we don't mention that one too much.
I feel like a lot of artists have that one record that they don't want anyone to mention
I had a conversation with a friend about that one day. It was like, does Bruce Springsteen have that album? Like, does he have that one record where he's like, no, we don't talk about that one?
It probably, because it's probably that same thing of, I would imagine when you get to a certain level of fame or you become an icon and you're still playing shows, it probably gets so tiring playing the same hits that everybody wants to hear every single show. Like, we just talked about this. You just saw the Pixies a bunch Weezer a bunch. Were Weezer playing the hits? I
don't know. Pixies played two almost completely different sets back to back. And then, back to back days. And then Weezer played pretty much the same. I think only one song was different on each day. And so, like, I don't know. For me, I feel like as much as you might have the problem of, well, we don't talk about my first album, I kind of think, like, going along the lines of Bruce Springsteen, now he's just kind of recording albums for the sake of recording albums. Like, he might play one or two songs off the new ones, but he still pretty much plays the hits. And, like, I think that's just as much of a curse as having your career go on so long that you're really only making an album so that you can do another tour.
You almost become a cover band of yourself.
Yeah, actually.
Like, you kind of...
Or it's not to reference the hit TV show Nashville, formerly on ABC and now wrapping up on CMT. a buddy of mine's sister is on that show. But I remember at the first few episodes where they wanted her to do a best of album. And I've always wondered what that feels like to be an artist and then suddenly get to the point where you're releasing your best of albums instead of creating new music. You know what I mean? Like,
it's got to be debilitating.
Because, you know, I imagine you get into this to be able to express yourself and put your words and feelings and emotions out there to the public, and then to really not be able to do that anymore because people want to hear the same five songs every time would get frustrating. But okay, we'll say three albums for the sake of not talking about the first one. And you said you recorded that in your apartment in Philadelphia. As far as the other albums that you've put out, what was the recording process for those? Like, were you recording sort of by yourself in your apartment? Did you record in a studio? Has it sort of changed as time has gone on?
If I can remember correctly, I know the very first one that we did when I moved back from Philadelphia, it was the first album that I made with a band. We did that at Stable Studios in Chambersburg. Spencer File, the Stable Shakers, he has a little great little studio. And it was such a quick process that I think we did it in maybe like four or five really small sessions. We were coming in after work on weeknights and just laying down tracks as fast as we possibly could, and it turned out really well. And it did, and that album did the same thing. It did the next job to get to the next album and increase the fan base and everything. The next albums were all home studio. Part of the reason why is because, as maybe not so much anymore with a baby at home, but I'm a night owl. So working at 1, 2 a.m. is a normal thing for me. And it's tough to call up a guy and say, call up the engineer or your drummer or your bass player and say, hey, time to work at 2 a.m. So investing a little bit of money into a home studio gave me the flexibility to be able to work odd hours. So then the next three albums were all recorded at home. The last album... everything was actually done at home on all the albums except for the last one, where I gave that to a friend and he did the mixing and mastering separate, which is a very nice thing, I think, for musicians to do, because sometimes you're so close to the songs and you need an outside ear. So that really changed it sonically for us.
I feel like also mixing is where it can go drastically wrong too. Like, you can have the best songs, and if they are mixed poorly, it you're gonna hate it. And I think having outside ears is kind of a good thing to have on it. What was sort of the time span between those albums?
The one that we did at Stable Studios was, I think, 2013, because that started right... I recorded that just a few months after I started playing music full-time. And then it was probably late 2015... in early 2016, two albums came out together. One was a solo album, one was a band album. And the solo album came by accident because we were recording the band album, but I had a bunch of special guests, guys from like Jerry Rigged and Wings at Buzz and all these different bands from around the area. I never get to see my friends play because we're always out playing on the same nights. So in order to at least play with them a little bit, I had them come in as special guests. And some of the people couldn't do it because the holidays were getting in the way. So from like November to January, I just spent the time and recorded a solo album in that downtime. Released that, I believe, in early February. And then right after that, once we wrapped up the special guest tracks, I released another album right on its heels. And then my most recent album came out in the fall of 2017.
Do you feel like there's any... I feel like in... how do I want to say this? With larger artists, there is sort of this pressure to constantly be putting out new content because we're sort of in an era where everybody is consuming content constantly. Yeah. Do you sort of feel that pressure of, I need to sort of constantly be either putting out new music or touring or... you know, got to keep the brand up, got to keep, you know, the hustle going. Yeah. Do you sort of feel that?
There's certainly a pressure there. It's not anything that you know, gives me too much anxiety about my career. Because the nice thing is I manage my own career. Mm. So it's, you know, I don't have somebody breathing down my neck saying, got to get this new album out. Mm. But it's funny you say that because I did this year, I was planning on not recording an album this year. But I'm releasing a song once a month, a brand new song. And all I'm doing is just setting up a microphone, kind of like what we're doing right now, just sitting at a table, recording it. And whatever that live take is, that's it. And it's supposed to be fun in the sense of people get to hear the song whenever they're really new. And then they can almost compare them. That was always one of my favorite things to do, is to listen to artists, you know, the B-sides. And hear a song that sounds completely different than the finished take. But releasing one song a month kind of goes along that same aspect where it's like, it'll give me a chance to do some research to see if people latch on better than releasing an album a year or every 2 years or something like that. Releasing one new song, staying in my listeners' heads a little bit more frequently. So far it's been doing well. It's just making sure that I'm actually finding the time to sit down and record the song, get it out.
I feel like a lot of people that we've been talking to are sort of the mindset that singles are the future, because Ottawa's doing that, the Barons are doing that. Very few people, I feel like, are recording EPs or releasing EPs or releasing full-length albums. It's kind of easier to release singles. Then put out a full album, because I think people want to hear singles more than they want to sit down and listen to 13 songs in order, which is something that people don't really do anymore. It's interesting that's kind of how the tide has come for a lot of artists.
I agree with you, and I agree with all those other bands. I think that is where possibly where the future, we pretty much already there, but where it's leading to, it's kind of discouraging too, because, you know, I remember as a kid that was my favorite thing to do, was to put on a record and sit right in front of the stereo full volume reading the liner notes and reading along with the lyrics, and you had to, that was, you know, you could get a sense of what that band meant from song one to song 13. Now it's here's a quick snapshot of who I am, and if you like it, maybe you'll look at the next snapshot, or you'll listen to the next song. It's definitely the era that we're in.
I think that's, though, the people who kind of want to go against that, I think that has led to the resurgence of vinyl, because everybody that I speak to when they come in here, we're in my vintage clothing and record shop recording this episode, when they come in here, they talk about how when you have a record, you have to listen to the whole thing start to finish.
Yep.
And that is such a different experience than just sort of picking and choosing the songs that you want to hear by an artist on your phone. And it is, you know, it is weird that it's sort of going in two directions. Either people just want to have constantly consumable content that comes in the form of singles, or they want to have sit down and actually listen to music, listen to a record, have the atmosphere laid out in front of them of a record.
I also feel like singles today act as snapshots in time. I mean, albums may do the same, but, you know, the world moves so quickly nowadays. Although I feel like that's a statement that's been said forever. At the same time, I mean, it very factually is true with social media and the news being a 24-hour cycle. You know, the snapshots in time represented by singles make sense, especially for top 40 artists who are trying to capitalize on that kind of stuff. Not saying they all do, but, you know, for some people that very much is their trademark. Yeah. So singles kind of are really effective because they make statements or make messages easily accessible so quickly.
It's like little bite size. It's almost like singles are headlines.
Sometimes. Does that make sense? Well, sometimes.
It's these little bite-sized pieces of information, like the way skimming the headlines would be, is you get these little tiny
get
bits
right
of
to the point as fast as possible
to be able to bring in the attention of the general public.
It's frustrating as a songwriter because I mean, like a band like the Pixies or myself or you know a lot of great great songs. I'm bringing up the Pixies because a lot of times they have songs how they start is not how they end, and if you get 30 seconds into it and you're like, a lot of people go, nah, I'll skip it because I have that opportunity. I can hit skip now. I don't have to listen to the whole record. But, you know, sometimes that magic happens in that last 2 minutes because of where they're going to take that song you on that sonic ride. It's frustrating as a songwriter.
I can't imagine anybody listening to the Pixies today. Like, for the first time, if Gouge Away is the first song that you hear by the Pixies and you have a 40-second bass intro just going on and on, I can't imagine anybody, you know, in today's platform deciding to give that song a shot. So, yeah, it's very... You have to wait out the ride sometimes.
Sam is a massive Pixies fan, if you can't tell by the hat.
By the hat and the tattoo.
And the tattoo that you can't see right now. But, yeah, it's interesting. I love...
I like it and I hate it at the same time.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, I have so many emotions about it. But it's always interesting because these interviews either go one of two ways. We tend to talk about the business side of things and the business side of being an independent artist or sort of the writing aspect. And more often than not, it sort of leans towards the business side of thing and how you're surviving as an independent artist, which is such a crazy thing to do, but so many people do it. And it's where those two places meet, I think, is sort of how where we're releasing music is, or when we talk about releasing music, is this is my art, but I have to be smart about it in order for people to actually listen to me. But as well as like recording and releasing music, you tour a lot. And I sent you the link to our interview with Cody. And I mentioned in our interview with Cody Wilt that you, for me, were the first artist that I saw when I started in music that was touring constantly, was making a living out of doing music, was doing music full time, and just touring everywhere or just always having shows booked is what I saw. How did you sort of get to that point of constantly playing shows? Or how many shows did you play last year, I guess, is a good starting
point? I play about 120 a year.
Okay. As far as what's your general sort of market for that? Are you playing mostly locally? Are you touring sort of around the East Coast, the tri-state area? That sort of thing.
I would say the normal area is basically, I tell people it's basically from the Finger Lakes region of New York State to roughly, say maybe Southern Virginia, maybe a little bit into North Carolina. That's the normal, I'm leaving on Friday, I'll be back on Sunday type thing. But every year there's always a lengthy tour that extends somewhere around 10 or 12 different states down the East Coast and the South. Not this year because of the baby, but so the touring's been a little tricky this year, but the I normally, if I'm talking to somebody and they say, where do you play? I generalize it as just the East Coast, up and down from basically Georgia to New York.
When did you pull the trigger of, I'm gonna do music full time?
I think this is my fifth year, so I guess it was 2013. I was moving back from Philadelphia, and I was just really tired of that sitting in a cubicle. And it was just, you know, it, when you're sitting at your job and all you're thinking about is music and you're writing lyrics while you're where you should be working and you're thinking up, you know, I need to practice this. I want to try out this chord progression when I get home. It just weighs on you so much. And then that's a little difficult to do in Philadelphia because of the cost of living. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's tough to make a buck and still pay the electric bill. So when my wife and I were moving back to the South Central area, South Central Pennsylvania area, we just thought we'd give it a try. And we came up with a 5-year plan. And it's funny because this is the fifth year, mm-hmm. but I think after like year two or three, we were like, okay, yeah, this is, so far everything's going the way that we planned. So I think that 5-year became an automatic 10 or 15, where it's a, we're going to go as long as we possibly can on this.
What were you doing before you did music full time? You mentioned sitting in a cubicle.
I was sitting in a cubicle with a headset on, talking to musicians. I worked at a company called Disc Makers.
Okay.
Made CDs and DVDs for artists. And you know, a lot of... I like to. I'm proud of the fact that I feel like I'm a nice guy in the music world, and part of that is because of all the people I talk to on the phone were not nice people. You know, you get the guy that calls in, and it's like, hey man, I need 4,000 CDs. I needed them yesterday. I said, well, it's gonna take a week, and then they just ream you out mm-hmm. for that. And it's like, well, you know, those machines only work so fast. And yeah, I guess if you want to hand over a $1 million check, we can bump you up in front of the. You know, the 5,000 other people that need CDs yesterday as well.
Not a direct comparison, but working in the fast food industry changed my mind on how I treat those kinds of employees now too. Because the amount of people who get angry at me for things completely out of my control, you know, I get that you ordered your sandwich 5 minutes ago and it's fast food, so you should have had it 5 minutes ago. But all I did was take the order, ma'am. Yeah. Like, please, just...
Well, let you're the surface. You, mm-hmm. They know there's a bunch of water underneath you.
But I'm the first person they can yell at.
Yeah.
The second person is the manager. The people who are delaying it, the chefs, they don't even get yelled at. It's either me or the manager.
We used to get threatened. There would be people that would be like, I'll come down there and I'm going to kick you and I'm going to do this and do this. And then you would look at their profile and they would say, you know, our business was in New Jersey. It was, they were living in California. Like,
that's a lot of gas. Yeah.
I think I'll be going by the time you get here. But
yeah, I don't know. I feel like I just watched other people be extremely nice to customer service workers, and I was like, oh yeah, no, that's what I want to do. Like, I wanna be known as being ultra sweet, and I feel like I've gotten a lot of the opportunities, even though like I am very in my head, very like no bullshit, just business. Get it done fast. I try to be as sweet and as kind to everybody. I feel like that's benefited me in being able to get the jobs that I've gotten over the past 4 years.
Yeah, there's a longevity to it.
Yeah,
people remember that.
You're so much more successful if you're nice to people.
One thing that I've noticed when it goes with business conversations or again with just a simple talking to someone who you're working with is don't just say thank you, say thank you and then add on like very much. It's really weird how when I say thank you to somebody, I normally say thank you very much. And the very much part, I've noticed a lot more people actually react to when you add those few extra words to the end.
It's more sincere.
It at least comes across as, yeah. You know, more sincere.
Is that a Midwest thing?
No, I don't believe so. Because I didn't start making a conscious effort to do that until I started wanting people to thank me at McDonald's.
But it's good to get back to touring after fast food workers. But touring, as far as like you're starting out with touring, the people who are listening to this podcast, our sort of main audience is other people who either want to become independent musicians or are doing it part time, or just people who want to understand how to sort of crawl your way out of the hole that is starting out in music. I feel like I always describe it as you don't start like at the bottom, you start in this hole because right. You have to beat out all the other people who want to do it as a hobby and then start to do it as a job. But when you're starting out touring and you're maybe entering a new market or you're traveling to a city that maybe you're unfamiliar with, how are you marketing those shows? How are you sort of advertising yourself to these markets, or how are you contacting bookers, or how are you putting yourself out there and saying, well, I've never really played in this area before, but you should still hire me anyway? Like, what's that process sort of like?
A lot of it is just, you know, breaking that ice on whether it's a phone call or email. And then the very first step is to have, you know, a decent product musically. We live in the world where, you know, if you do have a good product, you know, people are willing to take a chance on you. And maybe some of those places, whenever I was very starting out early was, I'll play for free.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually almost worked out in my favor, in a sense that they say, yeah, okay, cool, come on in. Hey, we're getting this guy for free tonight on a Wednesday night. And I would go in and I would just play to the best of my ability. And they would be so pleased with it musically, that and the atmosphere, and they enjoyed themselves so much that they would actually give me money. They would say, here's some, you know, here's gas money, here's everything. So rather than taking that risk and saying, here's what I need to make this happen, X amount of dollars, I would take that risk and say, I'll play for free. And that was one way of breaking in. The other way is finding great people like yourselves, because they're everywhere. You find them on Facebook. You find you know, somebody who else has a radio station, podcast, a music blog, or anything. People that just love being around music, even though they may not themselves be on stage, but they want to help support you. So, you know, you message them and they say, yeah, we'll grab some friends and come out. And it may only be 3 people and they may bring out 20. But those are the nights that really make being out on the road, especially if you're out there by yourself, memorable, wanting you to come back, keeps you wanting to get back in the car and do it again. And there's the third step is, can once you get that door open, don't let it close, keep going back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, the first tour was kind of for selfish reasons. It was just, I wanted to just travel. I have a romanticism with the road. But after doing it and saying, all right, well, how do I build these fan bases? You have to keep going back. And then it kind of, luckily, it's not a burden to keep wanting to go back. It's fun to keep going back to Charlotte and to Asheville and all these different cities. And because then you have family there, you have friends on the way, you make a vacation out of it. But at the end of the day, it's time to work. And that's the third step of the enjoyability.
Well, and then when you go back, you know, people who saw you that first time,
yeah,
and you made that memorable,
yeah,
they're going to come back and see you again. I think we've made such a huge effort whenever bands that we either work for or have played here before, if they play elsewhere in the area, we've made an effort to sort of go and see them and support them. And we've also started traveling to see them play in their home markets. So, yes, you know, traveling to Cleveland and traveling to Charlottesville and
Heck, doesn't even have to be a home market. Just, you know, going to New Hampshire just to catch a guy's show.
Oh,
you know?
we drove 13 hours to go see David Ramirez in New Hampshire, nice, who we had seen previously.
Did he know you were coming?
No, he didn't know we were coming.
Better.
he's just kind of an acquaintance with us. The one of the music videos that we produced for one of our bands, Ottawa, that director did a documentary with David Ramirez. And when the band said, hey, this is who's going to direct this video, we looked him up and watched the documentary and fell in love with David. And he is, you know, one of my favorite artists and one of my favorite people. And we saw him play in Cleveland at the venue that we go to all the time. And then he ended up playing in New Hampshire. And my mom's like, let's just go. We came directly back from Cleveland after shooting a video and recording podcasts, back to Pennsylvania, directly straight to New Hampshire, 13 hours. We get there. It's a barn at somebody's house that they're having the venue in. And he's outside smoking. And my mom goes, hi, I'm going to give you a hug because it's so good to see you. And we say, like, we drove 13 hours to come see you because we love your music and we love you as a person and we want to support you. And they were doing live recordings for that entire tour. And in it, you hear him say, and these crazy people that drove 13 hours to come see me, I don't even like myself that much.
That can really, you know, put a whole new energy in a tour.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of down, like just being in a car for 6-7 hours. And then, you know, you could end up having some really down nights. just from all the travel and the wear and tear of being out on the road. But then something like that always happens. Right when you feel like you're going to hit bottom, sometimes somebody that you're not expecting walks in. Mm-hmm. I've had that happen to myself, and it just completely rejuvenates a tour.
It sort of picks you back up. And I think I hear that from a lot of musicians that, you know, yes, touring is this incredible thing, but there's so much that goes into it that is so stressful and overwhelming, and your car breaks down, or, you know, all these terrible things can happen on tour, and they always still remember these like little highlights of these people that they've met along the way that have changed their outlook on touring. As far as like finding venues for touring, is there a way that you go about that? Particularly, are you sort of doing the, other artists that I know have played here, so I'm going to reach out to these people? Are you?
Occasionally, I'll do that. I did that a lot early on. A lot of the artists actually, I would actually contact them. It was weird. I would contact them and say, is it okay if I contact these places that you play at? Mm-hmm. And they were like, I don't care. Like, what do I care that you're playing this, you know, this place at? And I just thought, I always took it as a, you know, just a kind of a sign of respect, mm-hmm. in a way. Really early on, that's what I was doing. But now it's because I'm building a fan base in all these places, and I see these people, and we, of course, social media allows us to stay in contact, that or like if I send out an email to my mailing list, somebody will say, oh, you're playing in North Carolina, but I can't make that one because you're 100 miles away from me, but you should check out this place. Mm-hmm. And you start picking up that grassroots feel where, you know, people are recommending spots. And sometimes they're great. Sometimes it's a bust whenever you end up going and playing those places. But that's just part of the journey. And then, I think 9 times out of 10, when I go and play a show, I'll end up meeting somebody. I'll say, you should check out this place. Mm-hmm. And so then you just kind of got to keep a little journal in your back pocket or in your backpack and write those places down and check them out whenever you get some Wi-Fi.
Have you created sort of a network of artists, like other musicians, that when you are touring, like you sort of run into other people who are musicians? Sometimes. Do you have like a network of local musicians that maybe you talk to or you reach out to for advice on venues or any of that sort of?
Yeah, particularly if I'm trying to find a new venue, I will, if I run into a buddy, you know, out at a gig or at a show or something, I'll say, hey, I know that you played this place. What's it mm-hmm. like? Sometimes I get a little maybe too far away from home to constantly run into somebody who would be playing the other venues that I am. Because of the local guys that I'm running into, it's tough to, you know, there's not too many people that have played, you know, so-and-so brewery in Boulder, Colorado. Mm-hmm. So it's tough to get a gauge on that. But it's great. Just if you spend an hour on the internet, you can always find, you know, somewhere along the line, you'll find, like, go to the brewery's website or the venue's website and you check it out and you find those musicians, and then maybe do a little Facebook stalking or something. You can see them say, hey, I love this place. This is my favorite mm-hmm. place to play. You can pick up a vibe before you even hit the road to go to those places. So
that is.
It's a network. It's just some of those people might not know.
Doing that. Do you ever have any red flags whenever you're booking? Like things that stand out to you like, oh, maybe I shouldn't actually book this show. Maybe like a weird request or like something that if someone were to get a booking email, you would say just like, Take the L on it. Don't bother going through.
Probably the most that I've encountered is somebody asking. You know, I always introduce myself as an original musician mm-hmm. who might do some covers. Mm-hmm. If somebody says we need you to do this, or they say send me your cover list. That's a quick. Never mind. That date mm-hmm. got booked up. Sorry. Those are always red flags. Whenever I can't, because there's no point for me to go and play if I can't play my own material. So that's certainly a red flag. And the other one, to be honest, this goes back to our customer service conversation. If people are rude, that's not worth my time to.
Yeah.
And it's weird to be. It's hard to pick up rudeness in an email because some people are just short, just mm-hmm. to be short. But eventually, you hear like maybe somebody's just dragging it on. It's like it's taken 7 or 8 emails before you can even talk about a date. It's mm-hmm. just they're asking really odd questions about what you do, where you're from, and maybe that's just kind of a warning sign of, you know what, simplicity is what I'm shooting for. So
I was gonna ask if you ever ran into the issue of people like you try and book shows and they're like, oh, we only book cover bands. Yeah. Like that for me, and I feel like I say it in every episode, I have booked before, I will never do it again unless I absolutely have to. It is the bane of my existence. It was the thing that drove me crazy, booking for other artists. And it's so many times I would run across the thing of, I would find a venue, looked like a cool place, and I'd send them an email and they say, nope, we only book cover bands, which I have a whole rant about cover bands that I'm not going to get into because we don't have the time for it. But I feel like that has to be one of the most frustrating things as an original artist. Yeah. To be like, yeah, I want to share my music with the world, but we only want you to play covers.
Free bird.
Yeah, no, that's, or I don't know, that's, I remember booking for Rivers and that came up with like a venue in Baltimore, and I was just like, that's, as soon as somebody says like, oh, but do you do covers? Or if somebody emails me to book for here and they're like, we're a cover band, like, I'm sorry, we only do original music. Even though cover bands may have a bigger draw sometimes, you know, I would much rather keep my integrity of, and you probably feel the same way, I'd rather keep my integrity of, yeah, playing original music and a few covers than,
yeah, being, I'd rather, a cover artist. I'd rather have one person like it rather than 1,000 people liking, yeah, something that isn't mine.
Cover bands are, is a touchy subject for me. But I guess, and we also sort of talked about you traveling and being in different markets. Have you ever had to find your own openers for shows? Has venue ever requested, like, well, we need you to fill the bill in order, yeah, for you to book?
I've had it a couple times. It wasn't necessarily at venues that really called for it. Mm-hmm. That was the odd thing. I think it was just because, hey, you're from out of town, you know, we don't trust you type thing. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times what I would end up doing if I had to get to that point was, again, finding, like, hopefully that venue has their calendar up to date. Mm-hmm. I'd just find another artist, see if they're local, ask them if they'd be willing or if they know somebody that's willing. And it's always worked out fairly well. And a lot of times it's worked out even better than it might have in the first place, because then I can narrow down my set list. Mm-hmm. To, you know, I don't have to play 3 hours of all my songs. I can play an hour and a half, 2 hours, mm-hmm, of the songs that I think are going to come off the best to that audience. And so I've had to do it. Fortunately, not as much as I would like to. Sometimes, mm-hmm, the venue will say, hey, we're going to bring this guy in and he's going to play with you. So it's easier if the venue just makes that decision rather than, mm-hmm, saying, go find somebody. Because then if it's a market that I'm really unfamiliar with and it's going to be my first time there, then it's really just closing your eyes and throwing a dart at the wall, yeah, and hoping it lands on somebody nice.
I feel like I've had experiences with venues where either they'll book, you know, other artists and it's a complete disaster. But I've always found it weird when venues are like, yeah, we want you to come with a full bill, particularly when you are touring in a market that they know you're not from.
Yeah.
I always found that to be weird because we've never done that here. You know, right. We've always built our own bill. And for the most part, it's been
a lot of trust that the venue's giving you.
Yeah, well, you could for all we know just like not show up with, yeah, anybody and be like, well, I didn't find anybody, so, but I'm still here. Yeah. So it's, yeah, that is a lot of trust. And they could also just bring in the opposite genre. They could, you know, I always find the bills at other venues to be very interesting whenever I do a little bit of research on different venues, because sometimes you'll have venues that they have, you know, a singer-songwriter, and then they have a heavy metal, yeah, band right, yeah, after it. And it's like that, that doesn't line up in my head very well.
I've been to a couple of shows where the first act does not match up. I mean, Dinosaur Jr. had this one warm-up act. I think their name was like Easy Danger or something. And I mean, it was just this scream punk band, which the punk part kind of matches up, but nobody goes to see Dinosaur Jr. for a warm-up act that's screaming their heads off. Or I went to go see They Might Be Giants, and they had this band called Moon Hooch, which is basically a dubstep jazz band. It's two saxophones and a drummer. And they make this dubstep-esque sound with their instruments. And I don't know. I think it's kind of cool when I see bands that are willing to experiment with who they bring along with them or who they bring with them. You know, I mean, clearly those are bigger artists who might have, you know, a little bit more reach. But still, I don't necessarily mind when people go into the danger zone of bringing someone who doesn't necessarily match their sound with them.
And sometimes it works, because then if you bring along somebody that sounds exactly like you, it can get kind of monotonous for the audience. Mm-hmm. So if you have if you're a blues group and you bring along, you know, straight up country group or a jazz group or even a harder rock band, it might help each one of those bands stand out in a different spotlight and help put the focus on you a little bit better.
If Led Zeppelin were still touring today and they brought Greta Van Fleet with them as their opener, I couldn't do it. I can barely take like five Led Zeppelin songs in a row because Robert Plant's voice is just so, you know, one-sided that I get kind of tired of it. And then you have Greta Van Fleet, which is the same band pretty much sound-wise, that I might, you know, need a pause mid-show.
I just ended up with a sort of a question that's not on my list, but like if you could build sort of your ultimate bill to go see a show.
Like, I was going to make that one of our segments.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was going to do a dream band segment.
Yeah, well, not even dream band, but we could do that. That's a good idea.
Let's do yours. Dream show.
Like a dream show to go see, you know, pick three artists that you're going to go see lined up together. Not to put you on the spot, but.
Well, I would want probably my favorite rock band is the Black Crowes, so they'd have to get over their differences and stop being mad at each other. So I'd say the Black Crowes. This is one of those questions that, you know, later tonight at 9:00.
I know you're gonna think.
I should have said.
You're gonna have all.
Just send us a message when you do, and we'll screenshot it and we'll post it on our pages to be like, for the record, it did come up later. It's a tough question because on one hand, you know, is it something where you would want it to be, you would want there to be some sort of continuity with the sound, right? Or would you just throw three completely different artists together? Like, one of my first shows that I ever went to was I saw Ed Sheeran at the Ryman, and he had Foy Vance, who's an amazing, amazing songwriter, open, and then it was a hip-hop duo, and then it was Ed Sheeran. Like, when Ed Sheeran was still just acoustic, sad love songs.
As in the Ryman Auditorium?
Yes, in Nashville.
Oh, wow.
And it was it was just like, it was kind of a weird thing, but for some reason it worked. But I always stick out in my head as one of those things where the genres kind of were different between all the artists, but it still had a nice flow to it throughout the evening. That was one of my first concerts.
That's a pretty awesome first concert venue to be at.
And we were fifth row too, nice. Like, wow. Right up close. And Foy Vance, who is, you know, one of my favorite songwriters now, he literally just said, "I want everybody to be quiet." And you could have heard, they're like, no cheering, no, like, you know, shouting.
Listen, everybody, keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
Right?
And it was dead quiet, a single spotlight. You could see the dust particles floating in the air while he was playing. And it was a magical experience. I think that's an awesome, like, just first Ryman experience, too, to just have everybody. Okay, cool. I think we're gonna wrap things up a little bit. I have two last questions for you. The first one is, you know, what would you recommend that our listeners go and check out and listen to? Like, what artists have you been listening to lately that you would recommend?
Well, I actually had a chance to open up for him last year. I love him to death. He has a new album coming out in, I think it's early September, late August. His name is Cedric Burnside. He is the grandson of a very well-known blues artist, as long as you're in the blues world, R.L. Burnside.
No way. Yeah. I listened to R.L. Burnside.
Yeah. We were just listening, me and my little daughter, 3 months old, we were listening to him today.
That's crazy.
And R.L., it's great because it's almost like listening to R.L., but just in a modern way. It's it's really cool. There's a very nice heritage in that Burnside family of blues music. But he has a new album. I love him to death. He's been doing a lot of going live on Facebook at his shows lately. And it's whether it's just him, it's either just him or it's just him and a drummer. He doesn't use bass player, no piano players, nothing. Just guitar and drums, if that. And they'll rotate the guitarist and the drummer. He'll go back and play drums. It's really cool. So I recommend checking out Cedric Burnside. He's certainly one of my favorites. It was an honor to open up for him.
And then where can people find you? Website, social media? Where can people check you out if they want to learn more?
Everything is under my full name, Nick Andrew Staver, nickandrewstaver.com. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those are just the full name. And if you throw a dot Bandcamp on after Nick Andrew Staver, you can find all those songs that I was talking about, mm-hmm. the song a month, and every single album is on that website as well.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys, that does it for this interview. Thanks so much for tuning in. Be sure to tune in again next week. We post every single Wednesday. We are available on iTunes, Podomatic, and Google Play Podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at The Flat Nickel Podcast. Follow us on Facebook at The Flat Nickel Podcast. Make sure to drop us a like, a favorite, a subscribe, a 5-star review wherever you're listening, and we will be sure to get another episode out to you guys next week.